This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodi. We're in our 12th episode of Brainwaves. We're discussing DNA. We're going to do a 101 on DNA. What are genes? What really is DNA? Even just if we're 2 to 3% different genetically, how does that impact individual risks of neurological and other diseases, for an example? Understanding genetics can be a challenge, so we've decided to take a couple of steps back and talk to Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, our neurogeneticist, on to bring us back to the basics of the science of genetics. Welcome to the show, Dr. Azlina.
Hi, Mira. You're looking very nice today.
Yes, thank you. And Kong Si Fa Chai.
Yes, Kong Si Fa Chai.
Could you very quickly, and you know, it's ironic that this question, we had a family gathering at the end of December, and while we were all chatting, it's funny how one of my cousins said to me, can somebody explain to me the difference between DNA, what's a chromosome, what do they mean by, you know,
they need to tune in then.
Your genes, exactly, and it's perfect timing.
That's right.
Do you want to go through a little bit about the history of genetic studies?
Sure. So just sort of... before I get into that, I was reading to decide what to cover in this month's slot, and I came across a paper talking about these, what they call dark regions of our DNA, dark matter of our DNA. And they were doing experiments and they were linking it to brain development. And I was sort of, oh, you know, that would be really interesting to kind of talk about. And then I realized that for the listeners to really be able to appreciate what the dark matter really means, they need to understand a little bit more about the human genome itself and, you know, a little bit more about DNA. So that's how I sort of thought, you know, let's break it down a bit first.
Yes, exactly. Let's go through.
And then kind of build up. Yeah, so in terms of the history of genetic studies, actually, before DNA was discovered as the hereditary material, people used to think that RNA and proteins were the ones that were actually the main hereditary material. And it was only, I think it was in 1944, where there was a group of researchers, Avery, McLeod, and McCarthy. They did these really important experiments where they showed that if you just take DNA from bacteria and you transform it, meaning that you move it from one bacteria to another bacteria, you can sort of show that the DNA that you are moving is enough to be able to pass on those traits. And it's not the RNA, it's not the proteins. So that really was sort of what shifted the thinking to DNA. And then, of course, you have the Watson and Crick discovering the structure of DNA in 1953. And then after that, there were a number of really important technological breakthroughs, I would say, that really accelerated our understanding of DNA and our own human genome. So actually, a lot of our discoveries are driven by advancements in technology. So, for example, Fred Sanger, who developed the method for sequencing DNA, right? That was a method that he developed, which now can be applied. And I still use it in my lab, right? But that really was a breakthrough, because then people could start reading DNA sequences. But it was very laborious. It took a long time. And then as the technology improved, it got easier and easier to get those sequences back. Then, of course, in 1990, there was a consortium across the world that came together whereby they said, you know, let's sequence the human genome, right? And there was a lot of controversy at the time. They felt that it was a waste of money, etc. But the people pushed through anyway. And really, in about 12 to 13 years, it took them to sequence the human genome of a number of individuals. And because of that project as well, the Human Genome Project, that also helped to accelerate the other kind of technology as well that we're kind of currently using now, that makes it easier for us to do all the screening of our patients, etc. So the Human Genome Project was a seminal kind of project to really put us in the position where we are now, that we can really start to look at the human genome and try to understand, you know, how do we differ from each other, you know, human variation, how are we different from other animals, and how are these differences linked to our traits, you know, just any characteristic, and also to risk of disease. So So really, it's taken a very long time. And now, after the Human Genome Project, we have these latest technologies that help us to sequence our genome very quickly. So that is also helping us to find things faster.
Could we just take a step back and look at, you know, you mentioned DNA, you mentioned RNA, you mentioned proteins. What are they?
Okay, so DNA, do you know the full name for DNA?
Wait, it's a very long word.
Okay, deoxy.
Yeah.
Ribonucleic acid. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the name to describe the chemical structure. Okay, so DNA is made up of various different components. If you look at it, it's sort of like a ladder that is sort of slightly twisted. They call it a double helix. It has a genetic code, as they call it. So, you know, we have A, B, C, D, you know. But in DNA, we have just four letters, A, T, G, and C. And a combination of those letters make up the sequence. So, for example, some places it will be A, T, G, C, you know, and so on and so forth. So you can have different combinations. DNA is the hereditary material that stays in the nucleus that is in our cell. Mm-hmm. And the DNA never leaves the nucleus. It stays inside. And so RNA is a kind of messenger that is read from the DNA code.
Okay.
And RNA has many, many functions. It is an intermediary between the DNA and proteins. So proteins are made from the RNA product, right? And proteins, of course, are the components of the cell that actually carry out all the various functions, not all the various functions, but mainly most of the functions. For example, they are the enzymes, they are the hormones, they are the building blocks of the structures of the cell, the membrane, the cytoskeleton, for example, our neurotransmitters.
What about chromosomes?
Right. So a chromosome is basically just DNA that has been packaged into these very neat structures. So if you imagine, right, DNA, if you were to take one DNA from one cell, and if you were to stretch it out all the way, right, it would be about 3 meters long, okay?
Because it has various combinations.
Because it has 3 billion letters, so 3 billion nucleotides. So these letters that I mentioned, A, T, G, C, they're called nucleotides. That's the kind of scientific name. So you've got 3 billion, right? So to sort of fit 3 billion, it takes about 3 meters long of material. So this 3 meters long material has to squeeze into a super tiny nucleus, which is microns in diameter, right? So DNA has to sort of be packaged, you know, it has to be wrapped up and condensed and coiled very tightly. So during cell division, it's also very important for the DNA not to be too loose, because then you are at risk of damage or incorrect division of the chromosomes, you know, into the new daughter cells, for example. But these chromosomes basically are just our DNA that has been broken up into parts, into 23 different parts corresponding to our 23 pairs of chromosomes.
Yeah. So if I understand this correctly, you start with the chromosome, which has DNA packaged into neat structures into that one chromosome.
Yeah.
And then you have DNA, which is the chemical structure in there, which has the genetic code.
Mm.
And then you have, in the midst of all of this, you have RNA, which is the messenger between the proteins.
Yes, which is
and
read
the DNA.
Off the DNA.
Okay, yeah. Which is those 3 billion combinations.
Yeah, so the DNA is about 3 billion letters and nucleotides long.
Okay.
And so RNA is, they call it expressed or read from certain sequences in the DNA. And it's a much shorter product because you only read certain regions. You won't read the whole. So you wouldn't have an RNA product which is 3 billion letters long. So you would have much shorter products, typically corresponding to genes or other parts of the DNA as well.
And these DNA structures are always, this chemical structure is always renewing itself, am I correct?
So the DNA replicates. So every time a cell divides, the DNA has to make a copy of itself to ensure that all the offspring or daughter cells, as we call it, have the exact copy as the previous generation.
Okay, so when it replicates, the old ones die?
No. So for example, if you think of your skin cells, so you need to always renew your skin layer, right? So the existing skin cells will divide to make new skin cells. And so those new skin cells are an almost exact copy of the original cell that it came from. So one cell would divide into two, mm-hmm. and then those two would then go on to divide into two.
But the original cells remain.
Yes. I mean, they may over time age and then die, but genetic code is passed on throughout the generations.
And in this replication process mm-hmm. is where sometimes you can get DNA damaged.
That's right.
Can also get, and that's when things start to surface.
That's right.
When the replication process is not as efficient as it should be.
I mean, it is actually really efficient, but there are some instances where, for example, you may have
some forces interrupting that process.
Yeah,
perhaps.
You may have inherited an abnormal gene that makes an abnormal protein that is part of this process. So it can't repair the mistakes that are made. Mm-hmm. It can't detect the mistakes.
It replicates with the mistake.
That's right. Yeah.
And hence the problem.
Yep.
There's something called epigenetics where it's external influences on the DNA. You want to just go through what epigenetics is?
Yeah, so epigenetics is, as you mentioned, you can have changes or mutations that happen to the DNA sequence itself, right? So you change an A to a T when actually it should be an A at that position, but it gets changed to a T. And because it gets changed to a T, then that may then mean that the protein that is made is different. But epigenetics, it doesn't change the letters that are in the DNA sequence. It doesn't change, the A is still an A. But what happens is it adds a tag onto certain parts of our DNA. And epigenetics is particularly important when you talk about wanting to express genes. So some genes need to be expressed at certain time points in our life. So, for example, during a female menstrual cycle, you need certain hormones to be expressed. You don't want to be expressed all the time, right? But they need to be expressed at day ovulation stage, day one to day six or something or another. And then after day six, you want it to stop because a different hormone needs to be expressed, okay? So how do you kind of regulate this kind of on-off expression? So epigenetics is something to do with that process whereby you have a chemical tag. It's called a methyl group, so a CH3. It's a methyl group that's added on the nucleotides that are in the DNA. And because of that tag, it kind of alters the structure of the DNA a little bit.
What brings about that tag, though? What influences the tag?
Yeah, if you look at the literature, it can be a host of different things. So even, for example, they say stress, cellular stress can also cause it. Even diet, you know, smoking, for sure. There have been many studies that have shown that...
Pollution,
even aging, okay, can kind of add on these tags where they shouldn't be. So what you are doing effectively is that if the tag shouldn't be there, you are switching off that gene. So it should be expressed, but because this tag has been added on, that gene can no longer be expressed because it alters the way, the process that we make these proteins.
When you say express, are you saying...
Proteins are made.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not the replication process.
No. Replication is DNA replication. So when we say gene expression, it means that a part of the DNA, which is called the gene, that part of the DNA makes a protein. Mm-hmm. So you turn on the gene, so you make the protein. You turn off that gene, that protein isn't made.
Right. And the protein is the one that is a
that
component of all that helps us carry out functions.
Yeah. RNA also has quite a number of different roles, but the main player is the protein.
Okay. Yeah. So it affects the production of the protein.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So epigenetics, as they say, doesn't change the genetic code as such, but it can be permanent. So meaning even something that your grandmother was exposed to when she was alive, if you look at her tags, they may also be present in her grandchildren. Mm-hmm. You know, so it can be permanent to that level.
Okay. Yeah. We'll come back and find out how your grandmother lived and how how that has an effect on your health coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, our neurogeneticist in the studio. It's our Brainwave series. We are doing a DNA 101.
That's right.
What does all of this mean? Genes, genome, DNA, chromosome, proteins, RNA. I think she's gone through it. I somewhat have it in my mind. It's still not cast in stone in my head yet, but getting there, I think, hopefully. How many genes do we have?
That's a good question. I'll ask you to guess. What do you think? If I tell you, okay, and maybe those who are listening can also do it at the same time. If I tell you that a worm, the earthworm, has 18,000 genes, okay, if you were to hazard a guess, how many would you say humans would have?
A couple of million.
A million. Yeah, that's
actually... A million genes?
That's actually a typical response, because you think, well, we are so much more complicated than a worm. Surely,
of course,
the number of genes that we have must be, you know, exponential, right?
Yes.
So actually we have... So if the worm has 18,000, we have about 25 to 30,000 only. And that was one of the... really surprising discoveries of the Human Genome Project, because just like you, right, and a lot of other people even who were working on it, we knew, you know, the people who were working on it, they had sequenced other species with shorter DNA. So they knew from other earlier studies that the mouse had how many genes, the worm had how many genes.
It's just us thinking we're superior from
the
animals.
Yeah, so
right?
When they were kind of crunching through the data that was coming through from the Human Genome Project, you know, they were sort of, you know, thinking 100,000, half a million. And so then when one group was coming up with these sort of much lower estimates of 30,000, 28,000, they sort of started calling groups in other parts of the world and kind of going, you know, are you getting what I'm getting? And so, you know, in the end, they came out with this consensus that...
we're not that superior after all.
We have about 25 to 30,000 genes, some of which we don't even know the function of yet.
Yeah,
you know.
But what sets us apart from the worm, though?
That's right. That's
I'll never look at the worm the same way again, you know.
Even the mouse, actually, if you look at the mouse, yeah. The mouse has 25,000 genes as well. So okay. We're very similar. And actually, from a genetic level, we're 85% identical. So,
okay.
Yes, why don't we all look like mice if we're so similar, right? It's because of how the human genome maximizes our genes, right? So, for example, the mouse, if it has one gene, it makes one protein from that gene, okay? But humans, we can make 2, 3, 4 different proteins from a single gene. So actually, we may only have 25,000 genes, but we have something like 100,000 proteins, whereas the mouse has 25,000 genes and maybe 25 to 30, 40,000 proteins. So they're what we call proteome, or their protein pool is much smaller.
Right. And if you say proteins are components that carry out functions,
that's right.
That explains a
yeah.
lot.
Yeah. And so
it?
You can just imagine that, you know, if you have a cascade effect where this protein needs to bind to that protein, and that then will confer a new ability for that cell, then you can see how with more proteins, the complexity in the human cell is much greater, even though we share almost the same number of genes.
So is that why we carry out a lot of trials on mice research?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
they are about 80-85%
yeah, yeah,
similar
I mean,
to us?
Yeah, I mean that...
In terms of gene makeup.
That's right. So we assume that because a lot of their proteins are the same proteins as what we have in our cells, that they will function the same way. So that's why we use them as these sort of experimental models.
Let's look at this Human Genome Project. I mean, that mm-hmm. happened in the early 2000s. Mm. What came out of that? I mean, you did mention that, you know, there was a lot that came out of it. Mm. We understand a whole load of things now. How, you know, traits, the risk of disease, right from how different we are from other animals,
yeah.
right? But let's just talk about humans. We're very similar in terms of gene makeup, but you and I don't look the same.
Mm.
So what is that 2 to 3% difference that's genetically different from you and I?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what came out from the Human Genome Project? So there were a number of sort of surprising discoveries. Number one was the number of genes was much lower than anticipated. The other thing that they found was that actually out of the whole human genome, the genes only made up 2 to 3% of the entire genome sequence. So for example, as I said, if you were to stretch out a single DNA molecule from a single cell and stretch it out, it'd be about 3 meters long. And if you were to then take all the genes that are lined up along that 3 meter long, okay, because they are distributed along 3 meters, okay, and if you were to just kind of, you know, zip them all so that they all come close to each other, mm-hmm. that would only take up 3% of 3 meters.
Right.
Right? So very small. So meaning that 97% of our DNA aren't actually genes. They are these, what they call non-coding. So if you look at some articles, they may refer to genes as coding regions. Coding just basically means it codes for a protein. So non-coding means that this is a region that doesn't look like it is a gene, because you can genes have certain signature profiles that need to be there so that the cell knows that it is a gene, basically. So if you were to look at this 97% of non-coding, they don't have these signature motifs or sequences. So you can sort of safely say that they're non-coding. So it was really, that was a big surprise, you know, because why do we carry around this seemingly unnecessary part of our DNA, right? And so after the Human Genome Project, what came about was the ENCODE project, so ENCODE project, whereby they're trying to understand more about this non-coding part of our DNA. And what they found was that genes on their own cannot turn themselves on and off. The sequence of a gene is just what is going to make up the protein. But what turns on the and off the gene is not encoded in that sequence itself. It's actually in the non-coding part. So these non-coding parts are these on-off control panels. And if you actually did experiments where you remove these non-coding regions, you don't get any proteins.
Right.
Or the protein expression is altered. So the reason why we still carry all this non-coding part of our DNA is because it used to be called junk DNA, mm-hmm. because people knew it was there even before that, but they didn't know just that it was that much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's why they called it junk. But we know now that it's not junk, obviously.
It's crucial.
It has a huge role to play in regulating, you know, when the genes are expressed. Yeah.
So from the Human Genome Project, where have we come so far? You now can, you know, sequence your genes. The cost has come down.
Yeah.
You can do genetic testing for various, diseases and things like that. Do you think we're making progress? I mean, sometimes commercial elements come into this whole idea of gene testing and all of that. I mean, where do we draw the line? How accurate is it, you know?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think even if you look at the Human Genome Project, right, the people that they sequenced for the Human Genome Project were used as what they call a reference, right? Because they looked healthy. They didn't have any kind of family history of any obvious diseases or anything like that. And so when we do our research, we use their genome. We compare, say, our patient DNA with the reference genome, okay? But now there is no perfect genome. No human has a perfect reference genome, right? We are similar in some ways, but even identical twins can vary. So it used to be thought, of course, you know, identical twins used to be thought 100% identical, at DNA level, right?
Yes.
But now, like I said, with the more we understand the structure of the genome and the more we can use better technology to read the sequence, the more we're finding out that even identical twins are not 100% identical. So the types of variation that we can have, it used to be thought that we were 99.9% similar.
Yes.
But even that 0.1% actually relates to something like, you know, millions of positions within our DNA, right? I was doing a quick calculation last night. So for example, you know, we could differ between 90 million, just you and me, we could have 90 million positions or locations in our DNA that you and I are different from each other.
Right. And that would include proteins.
So that would include differences in regions, in the coding regions, so the genes, and also in the non-coding regions. So if we had differences in the coding region, then, you know, that could explain quite simply, you know, differences in eye color and height and things like that. But what about the differences in these non-coding regions? So, you know, that could also be that you play about with these control panels. So, for example, you could have a change in one of these switches that makes the cell able to express the gene for longer in me than, say, in you. So these variations, whether or not they are in the coding region, in the genes, or in the non-coding regions, can still have an impact in how ultimately we are variable in terms of just our general characteristics, and also then, of course, you know, how, if those abnormal proteins have a role to play in disease, then how we could also be at risk of getting diseases.
You know, we would read headlines, health headlines, that say the gene for Alzheimer's disease has been found. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean?
Yeah, well, that, I have a special problem with that, because actually when they say the gene for, you know, Alzheimer's disease has been found, I mean, in one way, they are accurate, but it's not to say that people who have Alzheimer's disease have a special extra gene that we don't have. We all have that gene, right? So, for example, one of the most common genes that are implicated in risk of developing Alzheimer's is a gene called apolipoprotein E, or ApoE gene. Everybody has the ApoE gene. It's just different forms of that gene.
So what's happening? There's a tag on it? Or are you saying
no,
that...
No, so the sequences are different.
Different.
Yes.
So is that the non-coding side of it that's controlling the, how this gene is expressing itself?
So for the ApoE is the coding, so the protein is different.
Okay.
But you can have variations that change the non-coding that can also have an impact on that particular gene and on many other genes.
Okay. Yeah. And so coming back to the gene testing thing, I mean, is that just the tip of the iceberg? I mean, when you get tests, you know, gene tests coming back to you and you say you're predisposed to this, that and the other, but what does that really say?
Yeah.
Is it saying very much?
It depends what you're testing for. So if you are testing for a clear-cut, what we call single gene disorders, whereby like thalassemia, sickle cell anemia, not so common in Malaysia, but you know, other sort of diseases where we know that if you have a mutation in one gene, you are going to have that particular disease. So if you are doing genetic testing for that, then that is quite straightforward. But the problem with a lot of the commercial companies now is that they are making it very easy for you to send them your DNA.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, you know, you just need to kind of use something that looks like a cotton bud and just sort of swab the inside of your cheek and send it off to them. And a few weeks later, you will get a result that tells you your risk of diabetes, your risk of heart disease, you know, your risk of getting lung cancer, et cetera, et cetera. And they're basing it on some research that has come out that has sort of looked at these changes that you can have in the DNA that have been associated with the risk of getting lung cancer.
So when it comes to the DNA, if you say it's the changes in the DNA, you're saying something sort of affecting the replication process, perhaps?
The protein, making the proteins.
Protein,
yeah.
Okay.
Or also it could be the replication. Like in cancers, a lot of what goes wrong is you have DNA damage, but it's not being repaired effectively. So then that then leads to more and more mutations accumulating in these cells. So you have, you know, many more things can go wrong because you can't repair it. Because normally, if, you know, we are actually, our DNA gets damaged, you know, you can have something like 120,000 of one particular type of DNA damage happening per cell per day.
And can't you find out this, figure out that the fault in the replication process really early before it actually mutates and becomes worse? Because what you're saying is once it replicates wrongly, it just continues to...
So you could have a DNA mutation or a change that has occurred because the DNA has been damaged, and then that particular mutation is passed on across generations. You can then have a situation where a single DNA mutation occurred, and because the cell is not able to repair it, that one is also passed on. But then other mutations that also arise cannot be repaired, and those are also passed on. So you get an accumulation. Just to say about the genetic testing, so the problem with the genetic testing is that a lot of what they're basing these assumptions on are not necessarily proven, and they may not really look at your whole lifestyle to be able to really give you an accurate prediction of your risk for disease. So, for example, if you were to get tested for a variant in a gene that has been associated with lung cancer, okay? So let's say it comes back and it's negative, meaning that, you know, you have a very low risk of lung cancer, but you are a heavy chronic smoker, right? A chain smoker, you smoke, you know, packs and packs a day. of course, your lifestyle will also have an impact, right? So when you get that genetic report back from your genetic testing and saying, oh, you know, I'm at zero risk of developing lung cancer, you try to convince your loved one, oh, it's all right, I can still smoke, yeah. But of course not.
You know, when they say you've inherited good genes, what does that mean?
Well, normally they mean that you haven't inherited any genes that are putting you at high risk of getting diseases, or, you know, especially in the fashion world, they always say, oh, you know, she's got good genes because she, you know, she inherited her looks from her parents, etc., or, you know, they're particularly athletic. Yeah. So normally that means that they're saying that you've got genes that have given you positive, desirable traits.
Yeah, yeah. Which happens as well. We're always focusing on the damaged part or, yeah, you know, the inherited problems. Yeah. But what about my going back to my grandmother and how she lived? Will that affect my health?
Yeah, I mean, from an epigenetic point of view, it's more and more is being researched into the role of this, these tags and how long they last. And how are they, if you can remove them, how are they removed? How are they added on? You know, all that is still kind of not fully understood yet. But there was a study that showed that if you are not a smoker, let's say yourself, right, but your grandparents were smokers, and because of that smoking, that affected the DNA that were in their germ cells, either the egg or the sperm. And so then if your parents were a result of the egg or the sperm that were fertilized that had the acquired tag. These tags, mm-hmm. then, and so then your parents would then have it throughout their whole body, and then they would then pass it on to you in their germ cells and so on and so forth. So that's how even how your ancestors lived can also, ooh, have an effect.
I would worry about the future generation.
I know. I mean, how much guilt
I would safely say we inherited pretty good cells,
right,
just by the lifestyle they led, and, you know, and look at us now, and what are we going to pass on?
Yeah, the changes can be very subtle, you know, and it can be something that was acquired during your grandparents' time, and then something that your parents acquired and something that you acquired. And so in combination, they may not have affected your grandmother, they may not have affected your parents, but when you acquire your own set of epigenetic changes together with all these other ones that you've inherited, so together that may then cross this threshold, which then you start seeing various diseases. So yeah, so there are also other types of variation that you can also have in the DNA. So the ones that people talk about a lot are these, what they call single nucleotide polymorphisms, so, or SNPs for short. So that's when you have a change in just a single, mm-hmm, nucleotide. So like the example I gave earlier, you have a single A changing to a T, or a C changing to a G, for example. So just single letters are changed. You can also have much larger regions that are altered, and normally we call these copy number variation. That is also a huge field that is coming up, showing that, you know, you and I may have different numbers of genes. Typically, it's thought that every individual has two copies of a gene. But actually, we know now that that's not necessarily true. For some genes, some people may have three copies. Some people have two. Some people have four. Some people have one, right? And so the example that I always give in my class is that, you know, you always have that friend who can have fries, right? And she never puts on weight. And so why is that? And, you know, you just need to look at, smell at the fries and you put on weight. And so, you know, that's not fair. So I always sort of say that, you know, you imagine that if these copy number variations included a gene that was involved in, say, breaking down or metabolizing the food that you're eating. So if you had more copies of that gene, perhaps then, you know, you actually don't put on weight so easily because you metabolize. But then if you only have a single copy, right, of that gene, then maybe it's harder for you to kind of break it down and to kind of, you know, avoid the kind of fat deposition, for example. So, you know, you put on weight. So it could be that these copy number variations could also be having an impact on those sort of traits, you know, that we don't normally think about. Yeah.
Okay, my goodness, that is absolutely complex.
Yeah.
And it gives me a whole new perspective as to Wow, just live your lifeline. Hope for the best, really, because if you, I mean, it's great. There's a lot of research going into it for cures, for diseases and stuff like that. But to understand it, I mean, it gives me an idea now as to how you can inherit the tags, you know, that sort of thing. So why do you think it's important for us to understand this whole idea of genetics? I mean, basics. Why do you think we should be empowered with this knowledge?
Yeah, I think we're coming to an era whereby it's going to be inevitable that more widespread genetic testing is going to be part of our healthcare system. And we're going to be offered all sorts of these other genetic testing by these commercial companies. And, you know, how much do we believe the claims that these genetic testing companies are making? And how then do we help ourselves to interpret the results
findings
that we get back from the, you know, so for example, like a blood test, you know, you know, most people can be taught how to read their blood tests, like protein levels, cholesterol levels, for example. So, you know, we're coming to that stage where, you know, we're going to be able to sort of send your DNA off and come back with a report and sort of say, you know, that you are, this is what your genetic profile is. And so I feel it's important for us to have an understanding of it, because then, you know, of course, it makes you understand your disease or your condition better. But not only that, there's also these things that people are going to try to exploit. For example, they will offer genetic testing to families that have children who are undiagnosed, okay? And they will sort of say, you know, if you send your DNA to us and, you know, we will look through the DNA and we will come up with, you know, a report at the end. Now, how much is the scientific basis really supporting that report? And you, when you get back that report, how do you interpret it? Because a lot of the time they just send you the report and then they're like, you know, 40% risk of, you know, heart disease. And what does that really mean,
correct,
you know? And from our own research, looking at Parkinson's disease, you also need to be a little bit careful, because these are genetic testing companies. A lot of their kits or their assays, for example, have been developed using data that has come out from the Caucasian population, right? So the Asian population may have some slight differences. So we know, for example, in a gene that we're working on called the LRRK2 gene, or LRRK2 gene, which has a number of different mutations on it, the most common mutation in Caucasians is absent in the Chinese and also Malays and, to most part, Indians. So if I was a, say, Malay person and I send my DNA off for this particular test for Parkinson's disease risk, right, and it will come back negative, but it's actually because they've looked at the wrong one, mm-hmm. you know. It's not one that is relevant to me. So that's where, you know, a lot of these sort of genetic testing companies, sometimes they push their assays out too early, you know, before there's enough sort of scientific basis behind it. And that kind of confuses the public, I feel. So, you know, I know to a lot of people, DNA and genetics can be quite abstract.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
but I hope, right, that somehow today you have a sort of, you know, you can imagine the structure.
Yes.
You know, I wish I could show a PowerPoint or something, you know, to sort of help you imagine it. But, you know, there's a lot of resources online if you did want to find out more about DNA and genetics after, you know, listening to this session. And please go ahead, because like I said, it's going to be part of, if not our life, but our children's future healthcare and also our grandchildren's future healthcare. So it's kind of, you know, being more aware and getting it more into our public consciousness, because we haven't even started to talk about the more controversial things like the cloning, you know,
yes,
that just was reported last month, and, you know, other things like eugenics and whether or not we should really be testing for other certain traits like athleticism and choosing people, you know, over others to get into prestigious football clubs, you know, just based on their genetic profile. We haven't even gone there yet.
Yes, we will.
Yeah.
We will make sure we do that, because, I mean, it does apply to our, you know, everyday life, and how does that actually work? So we'll come back and pick that up in the next episodes of our Brainwaves. Thank you for joining us today. That was Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, a neurogeneticist, on the 12th episode of Brainwaves, doing a DNA 101 for us on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.